in preparation for coming to this session. I went to see my eye doctor. As some of you know, I've had problems with my eyes. I've lost vision in one eye due to many retinal surgeries, and flying is something sometimes causes problems. So I there was some little vision disturbance, so I thought better I go check with the doctor than do it and have some problems. So I went to the eye surgeon, and he looked at it, at the good eye, or the eye that has vision, and he said, well, there is that condition which I knew of, which is called latticed retina. But he said, there's also a little hole in the retina, and traveling won't hurt it, but we should treat that now. And right then and there, he, of course, with my assent, and when he said it, the treatment wouldn't make a difference in terms of flying, he got in and did some laser sealing of the hole, meaning sealing all around the hole, which is very tiny. And though it was a short procedure, it was very painful. And then he said, but about the other, we really can't do any treatment, because unless it was an emergency, because if we did a treatment, the treatment might cause more vision problems than the problem itself. And as he said that, it sort of came to me, oh, I will lose my sight. Now, of course, we all will lose our sight when we die. And we may also lose our sight before that. But though I knew this conceptually, intellectually, this was a very immediate sense of, yes, this is possible right this moment. What's possible right this moment is any self call it characteristics that we believe will cease, will change. And though we all know this conceptually, if we reflect upon it for a few moments, it isn't something we all grasp and live immediately in the immediacy of being this present. We all believe there are various so-called things, so-called functions that we will have. Now, despite the fact that we can say words like impermanent, that's conceptual to us, just like permanence is conceptual. conceptual in the sense that we can talk about it. In fact, the only reason the Buddha talks about impermanence is because of the very strong sense that we have of permanence. Maybe short-term permanence, but permanence. Or maybe short-term having certain characteristics and abilities, others being in certain ways. But because we hold on to those so strongly, there's the need to say the fundamental teaching of Buddha is ongoing change, or ongoing change cause effect. Or, if I say it more immediately, living this moment as is. Not as we think it is and will continue to be. Not certainly as we think it should be, or was, or will be, despite the fact that we do that and react when we fear or feel it isn't the way it should be, I think it should be, despite the fact that we react when something occurs that doesn't fit our idea. The fundamental practice, if I use that kind of word, is being just this, giving ourselves away, embracing the intimacy of this moment. The intimacy of this moment in all the many ways this manifests for us. Inside, so-called, in physical, mental, emotional states. So-called outside, in how others are, the world is. And even embracing the reactions that we get caught up in about these, and yet not feeding them, not entertaining them, because it's just that that creates trouble for us. Now, this isn't something new, something that we have that other humans haven't always had. It's this tendency that we have that arises with being human to, as Matsu, Chan Master Matsu says, being preoccupied with life, death, artificially striving with conscious intent. That, he says, is what defiles, if we use that kind of word, defiles this way, this nature that is who we are. See, we don't have to create this moment, nor do we have to create any special abilities or capacities to truly manifest this moment as we are, whatever condition, blind, half blind, deaf, half deaf, hearing wonderfully, pitch perfect. Our very functioning, I would say mind, except that though the ancestors in Chan use the expression mind, or actually they didn't use mind. Mind is English translation, sometimes translated as heart mind. But they spoke of this mind is the way. Our regular mind, our ordinary mind is the way. We unfortunately, when we hear the word mind, go to mental cognition and conscious thought and narrow. See? So, when Lao says, what is meant by regular mind? It is being without artificiality, without assenting or dissenting, without accepting or rejecting, without considering anything as either impermanent or permanent, without holding to discrimination between ordinary or sacred. See? It's being and responding to circumstances and beings right now in all our activity. He says that's the entirety of the way. So in our sitting, in our walking, in our working, in our being with the doctor and being told, oh, there's nothing I can do to fix that eye. Or being told, you have cancer, and yes, we have this treatment. No, we don't have this treatment. Being told, yes, you have early stage Alzheimer's, and it's at a point when there's nothing we can do, as a friend of mine recently had a diagnosis. See, that's even that is in a way a step away from the immediacy of events and circumstances, pain and conditions. And our practice is to live fully the conditions we are at this moment, since the conditions we are at this moment are the whole universe coming together to support us to manifest the universe in all the various ways that it is appearing for us. And this is the simplicity of our practice and the difficulty of our life. The difficulty because we find that it seems so natural to react when it isn't fitting with what makes sense for us, with what we want, with what is pleasant, with what isn't painful, difficult. And yet, you know, quote Matsu once more, the way itself is the phenomenal world. None of its marvelous operations, as infinite as the sands of the Ganges, goes beyond the Dharma Dhatu. See, this is exactly, he says, the mind ground of the Buddha way. This exactly is the inexhaustible light. Now, he says this because he's offering this to all of us. I should say he's not offering this. That's not the right word. He's reminding us we don't have to do anything except live this moment. So, in our tradition, we use all sorts of phrases to remind us, whether a phrase like beginner's mind, only don't know, all sorts of other phrases. Nevertheless, as soon as we even use those simple words, we notice the reaction that we have to those, because we want to make something of it. An earlier ancestor, Shen Wei, said, when you hear an explanation of Bodhi and bring forth the intention to grasp Bodhi, when you hear an explanation of Nirvana and bring forth the intention to grasp Nirvana, when you hear emptiness and bring forth intention to grasp emptiness, purity, stillness, these are all examples of deluded mind, of being bound, tied up by Dharma, of having mistaken views. It's this attempt to use our capacities to take what we hear and think that we have to do something extra. And really our practice is to cease doing something extra. Then, right here in front of us is the wonderful life that we are, the wonderful Dharma, the wonderful life-death that we are, always available just as we are this moment, just as you are, just as everyone else you encounter is. Every condition is available just as it is. See? Though we say being just this moment, compassion's way, it's easy to say. And then we notice what we say is good and not good, what we have to fix. We don't have to fix ourselves and others. Simply respond as this present moment, which is why our Zazen is so simple. Breathe, be breathed by the universe. Be traffic sound. be the condition, this body, mind, room, as you are. And each of us is this condition in our particular way. Unique and perfect in the way you are. Not having to try to grasp and make yourself any particular way. Ancestors have said various things as ways to help us. And yet, if we get caught in those words, they don't help us. I'll say one more thing and then maybe we could explore this together and practice. So Matsu reminds us, what you now see, hear, realize and know is from the very outset, from the very beginning, your original nature. It is also known as original mind. And apart from this, there is no other Buddha. This mind's exists at present. It is not created as an experience, as an expedient or provisionally. There's no need to wipe it clean. Because the nirvana of self-nature, the purity of self-nature, the liberation of self-nature, the independence of self-nature are your mind nature. You are originally Buddha just as you are. There is no need to seek for Buddha in addition to this. You yourself are experience Vajra Samadhi, Diamond Samadhi. There is no need to conceive thoughts, focus mind, assume samadhi in addition to this. Why should you try to cut off your thoughts, do all sorts of mind activities to achieve when that will never work? Okay, this is enough for an introduction for us to clarify a little. This is, as I say, just to prepare us to really make the best use of this time of practice together, this time of session together. Because despite this being so, it's up to us to do what's called for in our life. No one else can do it for us. Not because there's anything extra we need to do, but because of the strength, momentum of habits that, in a sense, will take us off if we buy into them, if we give rein to them, if we allow them to cloud our vision and determine our response. Okay, I'll stop now, and if there's something that we could explore together. Let us do so. If you wish to change your position, feel free to do so. Yes,
I think most people, especially people in my age bracket, can relate to what you say about the experience of aging and seeing your abilities and faculties not being what they used to be. And it definitely is a practice there. I had the same eye surgery, the laser surgery that you did, in the very same circumstance almost. Just all of a sudden he said, let's take care of this now. And after it was done, I'm not sure I would have said yes after going through that. But regardless, it's a difficult practice, certainly, but what I find in my life is a more difficult practice is when, and I use the example of my mother, who's 93 years old, and she struggles a lot with being discouraged and getting upset about not being able to do the things, being more dependent, having to use a walker. All the things she can't do that she used to love to do. And she has bouts of illness because of very sensitive digestive system now. And the struggle in my practice for me is how to skillfully help, assist, be of value to her in that circumstance. And I have some difficulty with that. I want to say, well, everything's okay. You don't have to worry about it. It's just getting old. None of that means anything to her.
Yes. See,
so I'm not going to talk to her about Mazu and...
No. It's not to talk about. I mean, it's interesting you use the word twice. Used to be. See, whether it's used to be in terms of someone who looks back at so-called past, should be someone who's young and looks at so-called future, should be in terms of our ideas of the way others don't behave as we expect, or the circumstances of our life don't come together despite our expectation. See, that is our whole life, is the cause and effect of this moment, if I use big words, or simply this moment. And how to responding to it right now, that's really our practice, responding to how this is right now. And part of that, if I say it in a gradual way, grows out of our ability to keep noticing what we put up in between as our idea of what we can do, how we can do, what we should do, what we shouldn't do. These habits that seem natural to us, whether in terms of ourselves or others, they seem natural, and until we notice the strength and the automaticity of the habit and how that's hindering responding, how it's even hindering us seeing and hearing. Even the idea that you should be able to do something to make it okay for your mother to be in her 90s and to be not upset about losing that capacity. Even being with her and her not being happy about it, and being happy about being with her not happy. I don't mean that just glibly. I mean it's really responding to her with knowing that there's little you can do in a real sense, or maybe there is something she's asking you to do. I don't know at that moment. See, this is being beginner's mind, if I use that phrase, or being not knowing, meaning giving ourselves away to the world as it is, giving ourselves away to this moment as it is. That's what we're doing when we do Zazen, and hopefully continuing in other aspects of our life. As I said a few weeks ago, the Buddha's practice began when he encountered people who were sick, people who are old, people who died. Encountering that is encountering what our life is, what our life contains in it all the time. One of my teachers, Soen Roshi, remarked that he says, I rarely see someone who on his face has the acknowledgement, I will die. Meaning that living fully within the moment, because I can die right now. In order to be able to live right now, we have to know that we can die right now. Then all the various aspects that we hold on to and want and get upset about aren't a big deal. Need not trouble us or trouble others, or may or us trouble others about them. There's a phrase that I used to always hear in when I my early days of practicing Zen in monastic settings, where they would talk about die once on the cushion and then live freely. And I always heard it that way, you know, as a very macho, really put in all the and die. But really, it's a very gentle die now and live freely. Die now means die to this particular attachment or holding, and die in the, not in a dramatic sense, not in a forceful sense, but in the sense of being able to release the holding to this right now and recognize that you are as this moment is, not as some idea of how this moment, this person should be. It's not some terribly forceful, macho thing. It's the simple release of what's only a figment of imagination that otherwise can stir ourselves up to such internal, external pain and suffering and harm. See, we only stir ourselves and stir others with that if we hold on to it. So in a way, our practice is always dying into this moment. Not, I use the word die, but we don't have to. We could say being born this moment. Being born this moment, which means simply being this moment. And this moment means as the conditions right now are. And sometimes it means being able to notice, see, experience the various dreams that we have, or to use a fancy word, delusions we have about how I, others, will, should be. We don't have to get rid of those, but if we simply see them as they are, then they don't, to use the word that Matsu used, defile. They don't cloud our life, our vision. So, yes, your mother has a hard time when she reflects on what she can't do that she used to be able to do. But if we hobble along as best we can in response to the condition of now, then we can be joyful even in the painful, difficult situations. And that, not, in a way, has nothing to do with aging, has nothing to do with old age or sickness, has to do with the present moment and this human capacity of asserting self, entangling in attachment that hinders this present moment. Okay, let me not talk, because this was supposed to be your opportunity to say, not mine. So you bring up and then maybe we can clarify together.
I take it, you know,
well, who I am is this person that can do such and such. And it's not going to be that way.
But it's very good the word you use, discouraged. That, in a way, is really the teaching and practice connected to suffering. We mentally, in all sorts of ways, create images of what should or shouldn't be, even if we're in perfect health and youthful, vigorous, and have all sorts of things, yet someone says something to us that we don't want them to say. Someone doesn't agree with us. Someone threatens what we think should happen. Right there, we can go into discouragement or anger or all sorts of other reactions that perpetuate suffering for us and cause harm, suffering to others. Even seeing how others are different than how we think they should be, not seeing them as they are, as exactly our life, results in the harm and suffering reaction that comes from that. That's why Mahatsu emphasizes just responding to beings right now. I'll add on, as they are, as you are. That's the entirety of the way. Responding to the circumstance as it is the entirety of the way. And defiling it, if I use that English word that was used for a translation, is where we believe our story, whether we call it self-centered, whether we call it the reactive habit. And we are the only ones that know that when that's arising. And we can sense it if we're present, if we are, if I say it, being practice, being this moment. We can sense it if we're willing to be honest with ourselves. And then we can see what's called for to respond without being trapped and caught by that. But as you say, it's not so easy, because the strength of discouragement or other sides of anger seems so natural and strong, and so easily we buy into them. That's why we do zazen. So easily we want to live through them rather then let them die this moment, because they will, and then we can live freely, responding as called for. Yeah. Yes, Steve.
Well, the guiltlessness and remorselessness can sometimes be used to characterize a cruel killer. Uh-huh. And so, but it seems like Zen practice doesn't really focus on guilt and remorse.
I would say that there's times when it's important to atone. And in a way, our practice has formal times to do that, and informal times to do that. Atone is a form of remorse in the sense of being able to see how and where we've harmed others or even ourselves, and to be, on one hand, able to embrace and acknowledge that. Say, I spoke harshly, I was caught up, I didn't see you, or whatever. Guilt, is a different, there's certainly consequences, and that's part of it, is living the cause and effect consequences of what we know and what we don't know. That's exactly what our life is the cause and effect consequences of all sorts of things. A little tip of it, we can see, oh, if I didn't do this, if I did that, but most of it we can't see. And there isn't blame involved in that because it's right now. Can't go back 5 minutes, much less 5 years or 50 years. And yet, if we want to hold on to guilt in that sense, there are people who hold on to guilt for many years and sometimes even lifetimes and generations. I don't remember who it was. Someone recently told me about cousins that they have, but they said, we don't have anything to do with them. In my mother's generation or my grandmother's generation, we and them separated and had nothing to do with each other. So since then, we don't have anything to do with that family, even though we know they're our cousins and we know they're right nearby, but we don't have anything to do with them and they don't have anything to do with us. Generations holding on to this. I said, really? Oh yeah, we never even acknowledge them, even though we know they're there. And that, say, but when but atonement is really at one mint, if we think of it. And I don't just say it to play with the words, but it's really embracing what has happened and being willing to acknowledge to the extent. And of course, we only see a little piece. Sometimes we see a little more. We rarely see it from how the other persons saw it, and they rarely see it how we saw it. And nevertheless, we have the Gatha to do it in general terms. All harmful actions ever committed by me since of old on account of beginningless greed, anger, ignorance, born of my body, mouth, and thought, I now confess and atone for them all. We do that, we do bows, and then if there's something specific to do, we can do that. And atonement doesn't mean the other person is forgiving, happy, etc., etc. So, if someone wants to be, as you used the word, a psychopathic, I'll use that word, killer, that's more self-centeredness taken to the extreme, doing harm in all sorts of way. And if there's so-called no guilt and no remorse, we see that. Look at the wars going on in the Middle East right now, people chopping other people's heads off because of not even things they did, just because of how they were born and what faith community they're connected to, selling them into slavery or all sorts of other things. This is, humans do this. That's how entangled self-centered greed and anger and delusion is. That's how much we can fool ourselves with ideas of, you have to be my way or I'll kill you. Or worse. So yes, us humans have this capacity, and this isn't something new. The Buddha came from a clan, the Shakit clan, and they were, due to call it tribal politics, they had done something to upset another tribe, and that other tribe prince and the state, whatever, came with an army, and three times the Buddha sat in front of the army to stop them. And finally, he realized he couldn't stop that other. It would go on no matter what he did. And the fourth time he didn't, and his tribe, state, peoples were wiped out, killed by this other army. This is what the sutras talk about. There's a story of this. You could read the details. But yes, we people do these crazy things. And this isn't what we're teaching about. We don't see the Buddha saying, oh, this is impermanence, okay. But he also can see what he can do successfully and what we can't do anything about. So part of our practice is also knowing what we can do and what our capacities are and what they are not, and doing our best where we can. But we always can see for ourselves our practice in the immediate, in all sorts of ways. So we don't have to go talking about other people, because we can see where we get caught in self-centered reactive habits. We don't need psychopathic killers to look at where we want to hold on to our self-justifications for things. See, and doing Zazen often exposes us to those memories or those impulses arising just out of the blue, sitting in the quiet Zendo with others, and all of a sudden we could find anger arising, whether over the way someone else is sitting or breathing, or the way someone outside is driving by, or the way someone yesterday said something to me, or preparing for what someone's going to possibly say to me tomorrow, just out of the blue, sitting quietly. Right there is our practice opportunity to work with that, to make appropriate effort in order to simply be this that we are, so that we could respond directly and immediately as called for, as appropriate. Yes,
Frank. I'm aware that I'm going, that I'm mortal, that I will die. Maybe I die now. I mean, in terms of, just that's the process. And I certainly noticed a slowing down in a way that I had not anticipated. Because my recollection of my parents is that my mother in particular lives to be in her 80s, so it was very energetic almost all that time. And so I guess I had an assumption that I would be like that. But it doesn't seem to be happening quite like that. It happens, but also what I notice sometimes is that when I'm particularly aware of that, like I was ill. It was in the winter time. I had a fever and I couldn't do anything really. Just got to lay in bed. Is a thought about, well, how do I want to live my life if I'm going to? I'm mortal. Well, how should I live my life? As if there's some other way to live it, something else to do. Mm-hmm. But I think what you're saying is, if I understand, is that, well, actually it's just about, you know, practice. It's like just being here now, and then perhaps it'll clarify if there's something else, but just do what's in front of us. Is this what you're saying?
Yes. And doing what's in front of us means making choices when those arise. But embodying this moment as it appears, as it arises, means the conditions of being strong or being weak or being ill or being healthy, doing our best in embracing the world that we are this moment, or doing our best in not being blinded by the reactive habits when they arise, and they do, even if it's the, call it disappointment or discouragement of, oh, I'm not as strong as I used to be, or as I think I should be. And it's the opening, if I use that kind of word, as this present moment that allows us to open as the universe. See, we're not so-called inside, and there isn't me opening up something here to something outside. It's the opening of this whole universe in whichever way we sense and manifest it. Not something magical or special. That's why we say ordinary. And yet ordinary is very special because of how seldom we're willing to be ordinary. Yeah.
Just that sometimes when I'm aware of a reactive habit, when I'm able to be aware of it, especially if it's not another person, sometimes what's helpful to me is to also realize they're mortal. That they're going through stuff, and that not I don't mean it in a way that, you know, well, someday they'll be dead too. I mean, it's not like that. I mean it as, wait a second, this is a person who, they may be doing this, that, other thing, but actually I have no idea what's really going to happen to them. You know, and so, you know, let's just, you know, and then, because, well, I won't say anything further about it.
Yeah. Well, in a way that also gives us, we give ourselves sometimes permission to acknowledge that though they aren't acting the way I want them to, but they are simply this person subject to cause and effect, including reactive habits. And though they're not acting how I want them to, it might not be necessary for me to react to their reacting, for me to fix it or get angry about it or get hurt by it, if we can notice where and how that's happening. One to Tony and then Claire.
So what you just said, is that a description of kind of dying to that moment where there's an acceptance, a broader opening, a bigger understanding? Is that where that phrase you used earlier could be?
If you want to use those words, yes. We just have to be careful that we don't... We humans have a tendency, when we say bigger, we think bigger, better, bigger, more than the way it is right now, bigger some. So as long as we don't get caught in those words, but it's very simple. I mean, it's very simple because it's very immediate. There's a phrase that Shen Wei uses. Raising up one, all others come along. Meaning raising up one phenomena, one principle, one dharma. Everything else is connected to this. See, it's not some little. So this, you could say, is little, fine. This, you could say, is big, the whole universe, fine. Isn't any fixed separation so that all are connected to this one, and we just take care of this one, or we take care of whatever appears to us, and that's taking care of all the rest. Then we don't get caught up in bigger and smaller and more and less. See, that's the important part. In practice, I remember, well, I'll leave it. I was going to bring up something, but it's going off. I want this to be an opportunity for you all to instead of me. Stop. Claire, you want it?
I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about the difference between pain and suffering, you know, in light of your own condition, or, we all here experience physical pain at some point. I step on my toe, my neurons fire, I feel pain. But suffering in that context is created by me if I choose to. If I choose to complain about, you know, oh, I shouldn't have stubbed my toe, or I should have been paying more attention, or this rug shouldn't be here, or whatever.
Yeah.
Is all suffering a choice? Can we choose to not suffer through any suffering?
I will say that I think the word choose to is a trick word. It traps us because it doesn't appear to be choice to most of us. When we are upset about something, or as Cindy was saying, when you're discouraged, you don't have a sense that, oh, I'm choosing to be discouraged about this. So, I mean, actually in the class that we're reading Joko's book, we recently read a section where she talks about I remember false suffering is the phrase that she uses, but we use the word suffering. See, in a way the word suffering is a funny word. You could say it differently, to cast a different perspective. We are not going to be satisfied if we look for satisfaction in conditions being a certain way. So inherently, being human means that we will not be satisfied if we want it to be unchanging, if we want it to remain the way it is. If, in a sense, being pained is painful to us, and it is, that comes with the condition of being human. And in a similar way, being human means that when we don't get what we want naturally, and I say naturally, there's suffering. Naturally, when we get what we want and then lose it, there's naturally suffering. When we get what we don't want, there's naturally suffering. It's not, there's no blame involved in that. It's part of this human condition of, if you want to say, attachment and self-centeredness. And yet our capacity is also to go beyond that when we see the inherent ongoing change and inability for those circumstances and conditions to satisfy beyond that. They aren't going to remain unchanging and let us, what should I say, not have pain out of it. I mean, it might be that you die in your sleep and there's no pain, but so what? There's all the people around you who are pained by your dying, and our fear of dying enough causes us pain and suffering. Our not wanting to lose this moment. Ah, nice breath. I don't want to lose that. Naturally causes our, you know, suffering or pain about it. So I think to play with the words too much and to think, well, this one is pain, is natural, is just, you know, the physical, but there's this one that's the mental one and it's different, and there's maybe some blame. If I was better at it, I wouldn't suffer over it. That's getting caught in distinctions that are conceptually fine and we could play with them, but they're theoretical and they're not the way we live. We don't distinguish that for the most part. Even the Buddha at the end of his life talked about how painful it was even to sit upright. He said the only time this body isn't in pain is when I'm in deep samadhi, in sitting in meditation. Otherwise it's all just strapped together and held together like, you know, something falling apart. I'm paraphrasing, but he says that towards the end of his life. Look, that's why old age is old age. But youth has all its own forms of suffering. Actually, in classical terms, there are three different types of dukkha, which we translate as suffering. And so I won't go into all of them because you can elucidate them, and then you could elucidate each one in various ways, but that's not important. What's important for us is to see when it arises for us, whether as pain, whether as we call it suffering, whether we use the word discouragement, and then see what's skillful in embracing this moment so that we can be fully alive in it despite how it is and how it's not. And one of the wonderful aspects of sitting is that we're doing something that for the most part is very simple and ordinary, just sitting upright. Usually we could find a position that's comfortable and we do our best to, and yet nevertheless in the midst of that we could see where troubling tendencies come up and how to skillfully practice with those, because those same troubling tendencies arise in our day-to-day functioning with others and by ourselves. And once we can begin seeing where that troubling is occurring, we can also see what it's called for from us to, let us say, release that troubling into the moment. Doesn't mean it won't arise again, but to see what skillfully to do so that our life is, if I use the word, a bigger container where troubling arises and passes, discouragement arises and passes, suffering, pain arises and passes. Because it's just part of this universe of arising, passing. That's the nature of this universe. Okay, I'm talking too much. Okay. Thank you all.